two paces, the knights bowed. Geralt and Regis returned the bows, after which the four of them observed a silence of 10 heartbeats, as decreed by chivalric custom.
"Gentlemen," said Bull's Head, "may I introduce Baron Palmerin de Lanfall? My name is, as you may recall,
Baron de Peyrat-Peyran. How could we not?"
"We have an urgent matter for Master Witcher." Peyrat-Peyran got down to business. "Regarding, so to speak, a professional undertaking."
"Yes?"
"In private."
"I have no secrets from Master Regis."
"But the noble gentleman undoubtedly do."
The vampire smiled.
"For which reason, with your permission, I shall go to look at that charming little pavilion, probably a temple of quiet and private contemplation. Lord de Peyrat-Peyran, Lord de Lanfall."
They exchanged bows.
"I'm all ears."
Geralt interrupted the silence, having no intention of waiting for the 10th heartbeat to die away.
"The matter,"
Peyrat-Peyran lowered his voice and looked round timidly,
"concerns this succubus. Well, this nocturnal phantom, the one that haunts, which the Duchess and the ladies have commissioned you to destroy. Have they promised you much for the killing of the spectre?"
"I beg your pardon, but that's a trade secret."
"But of course,"
responded Palmerin de Lanfall, the knight with the fleur-de-lis cross.
"Your conduct is commendable. Indeed, I greatly fear that I shall be insulting you with this proposal. But in spite of that, I submit it. Relinquish the contract, Master Witcher. Don't go after the succubus. Leave it in peace. Say nothing to the ladies or the Duchess. And upon my word, we the gentlemen of Toussaint will outbid the ladies' offer, bewildering you with our generosity."
"A proposal," said the Witcher coldly. "That is indeed not very far from an insult."
"Sir Geralt,"
Palmerin de Lanfall's face was hard and grave,
"I shall tell you what emboldened us to make the offer. It was the rumour about you that said you only kill monsters that represent a danger, a real danger, not an imagined one, stemming from ignorance or prejudice. Permit me to say that the succubus doesn't threaten or harm anybody. It haunts people's dreams, from time to time, and bedevils a little. But exclusively adults,"
Peyrat-Peyran added quickly.
"The ladies of Toussaint," said Geralt, looking around, "would not be happy to learn of this conversation. The Duchess likewise."
"We agree absolutely with you," mumbled Palmerin de Lanfall. "Discretion is recommended in every respect. One should let sleeping bigots lie."
"Open me an account in one of the local dwarven banks," Geralt said slowly and softly,
"and astonish me with your generosity.
I nonetheless warn you that I'm not easily astonished."
"And we shall nonetheless do our best,"
promised Peyrat-Peyran proudly. They exchanged farewell bows. Regis, who had naturally heard everything with his vampirish hearing, returned.
"Now," he said without a smile, "you may also naturally claim that that was an involuntary reaction with an inexplicable impulse. But you'll be hard-pressed to explain away the open bank account."
Geralt looked somewhere high up, far away above the tops of the cypresses.
"Who knows," he said. "Perhaps we'll spend a few days here after all, bearing in mind Milva's ribs. Perhaps even more than a few days. Perhaps a few weeks. So it won't hurt if we gain financial independence for that time."
"Hence the account of the Chianfanelles," nodded Reynard de Boisfrin. "Well, well. If the Duchess learned about this, there would certainly be a reshuffle, a new distribution of patents of nobility. Perhaps I would be promoted. I give my word, I truly regret not having the makings of an informer. Tell me about the famous feast I was so looking forward to. I so wish to be at that banquet, to eat and drink.
but they sent me abroad to the watchtower in the cold, foul weather. Ah, what a blight! The doom of a knight.
The great and grandiosely heralded feast, began Geralt, was preceded by serious preparations. We had to find Milva, who'd hidden in the stables, and convince her that the fate of Ciri and almost the entire world depended on her participation in the banquet. We almost had to force her into a dress. Then we had to make Anguin promise she would avoid saying fucking arse. Once we'd finally achieved everything and intended to relax with a glass of wine, Chamberlain Le Goff appeared, smelling of icing sugar and puffed up like a swine's bladder.
"In the given circumstances, I must stress," began Chamberlain Le Goff nasally, "that there are no inferior places at Her Grace's table. No one has the right to feel piqued by the place assigned to him or her. We in Toussaint, nevertheless, avidly observe ancient traditions and customs, and according to those customs..."
"Get to the point, sir."
"The feast is tomorrow. I must execute a seating plan according to honour and rank."
"Naturally," said the witcher gravely. "I tell you what. The most noble of us, both in rank and honour, is Dandelion."
"The Viscount Julian," said the Chamberlain, putting on airs, "is an extraordinarily honoured guest, and thus will sit at Her Grace's right hand."
"Naturally," the witcher repeated, as grave as death itself. "And regarding us, he didn't reveal our ranks, titles and honours, did he?"
"He only revealed..." The Chamberlain cleared his throat. "That my lords and ladies are incognito on a knightly mission, and he was not able to betray its details or your true names, coats of arms and titles, since they are protected by vows."
"Precisely. So what's the problem?"
"Why, I must seat you. You are guests, and moreover the Viscount's comrades. So, in any case, I will place you near the head of the table, among the barons. But, of course, it cannot be that you are all equal, lords and ladies, for it is never thus that everyone is equal. If by rank or birth one of you is more superior, he ought to sit at the top table near the Duchess."
"He." The witcher unhesitatingly pointed at the vampire, who was standing close by, raptly admiring a tapestry that took up almost the whole wall.
"Is a count, but hush, it's a secret."
"Understood."
The Chamberlain almost choked in amazement.
"In the given circumstances, I shall put him on the right of Countess Nocturna, a nobly born aunt of the Lady Duchess."
"Neither you nor the aunt will regret it."
Geralt was poker-faced.
"He has no equal, either in comportment or in the conversational arts."
"I'm glad to hear it. You, meanwhile, Lord of Rivia, will sit beside the esteemed Lady Fringilla, as tradition dictates. You bore her to the vat. You are her champion, as it were."
"Understood."
"Very well. Ah, your grace."
"Yes?" the vampire said in surprise. He had just moved away from the tapestry, which depicted a fight between giants and cyclops.
Nothing, smiled Geralt. "We're just chatting."
"Ah." Regis nodded. "I don't know if you've noticed, gentlemen, but that cyclops in the tapestry, the one with the club, look at his toes. He, let's be frank, has two left feet."
"Verily,"
Chamberlain Le Goff confirmed without a trace of amazement.
"There are plenty of tapestries like that in Beauclerc. The master who wove them was a true master, but he drank an awful lot, as artists do."
"It's time we were going," said the witcher,
avoiding the eyes of the girls, tipsy on wine, who were glancing at him from the table where they'd been amusing themselves with fortune-telling.
"Let's be off, Reynard. Let's pay, mount up, and ride to Beauclerc." "I know why you're hurrying," the knight grinned. "Don't worry. Your green-eyed lady is waiting. It's only just struck midnight.
Tell me about the feast."
"I'll tell you, and we'll ride. And we'll ride."
The sight of the table, arranged in a gigantic horseshoe, signalled emphatically that autumn was passing and winter was coming. Game, in all possible forms and varieties, dominated the delicacies heaped on great serving dishes and platters. There were huge quarters of boar, haunches and saddles of venison, various forcemeats, aspics, and pink slices of meat, autumnally garnished with mushrooms, cranberries, plum jam, and hawthorn berry sauce. There were autumn fowls, grouse, capercaillie, and pheasant, decoratively served with wings and tails. There was roast guinea fowl, quail, partridge, gargany, snipe, hazel grouse, and missel thrush. There were also genuine dainties such as field fare, roasted whole, without having been drawn, since the juniper berries with which the innards of these small birds are full form a natural stuffing. There was salmon trout from mountain lakes, there was zander, there was burbot and pike's liver. A green accent was given by repense, late spring salad, which, if such a need arose, could even be dug up from under the snow. Mistletoe took the place of flowers. The evening's ornament was placed on a large silver tray in the middle, forming the centerpiece of the high table, at which Duchess Anarietta and the most distinguished guests were seated. Among truffles, flowers cut from carrots, quartered lemons, and artichoke hearts, lay a huge sturgeon, and on its back was a whole roast heron, standing on one leg, holding a gold ring in its upraised beak.
"I vow on the heron," cried Perak Peran, the baron with the bull's head in his arms, whom the witcher knew well, standing and lifting up his goblet. "I vow on the heron to defend knightly honour and the virtue of ladies, and I vow never, ever to yield the field to anyone."
The oath was rewarded with thunderous applause, and the eating began.
"I vow on the heron," yelled another knight with bushy whiskers, pointing pugnaciously upwards. "I promise to defend the borders and Her Grace Anna Henrietta to the last drop of my blood. And in order to prove my loyalty, I vow to paint a heron on my shield and fight incognito for a year, concealing my name and arms, calling myself the Knight of the White Heron. I wish Her Grace good health."
"Good health!"
"Happiness!"
"Viva!" "Long live Her Grace!"
Anarietta thanked them with a faint nod of her head, decorated with a diamond-encrusted tiara. She had so many diamonds on her that she could have scratched glass just by passing. Beside her sat Dandelion, smiling foolishly. A little further away, between two matrons, sat Emil Regis. He was dressed in a black velvet jacket, looking like a vampire. He was waiting on the ladies and entertaining them with his conversation. They listened with fascination. Geralt took the platter with the zander, garnished with parsley, and served Fringilla Vigo, who sat on his left and was dressed in a gown of mauve satin and a gorgeous amethyst necklace, which sat prettily on her breast. Fringilla, watching him from beneath her black eyelashes, raised her goblet and smiled enigmatically.
"Your good health, Geralt. I'm glad they put us together."
"Don't count your chickens," he replied with a smile, for he was actually in decent humour. "The feast has only just begun."
"On the contrary, it has lasted long enough for you to have complimented me. How long must I wait?"
"You are enchantingly beautiful."
"Slowly, slowly, with restraint."
She laughed. He would have sworn entirely sincerely.
"At this rate, I'm afraid to think where we might end up by the end of the banquet. Start with... say that I have a tasteful dress and that mauve suits me."
"Mauve suits you, although I confess I like you most in white."
He saw a challenge in her emerald eyes. He was afraid to take it up. He was in such good humour. Caer and Milva had been seated opposite. Caer was sitting between two very young and ceaselessly twittering noblewomen, perhaps the Baron's daughters. The archer, meanwhile, was accompanied by an older, gloomy knight with a pockmarked face, who was as quiet as a stone. A little further away, meanwhile, sat Angoulême, calling the tune and making a racket among some young knight's errant.
"What's this?" she yelled, picking up a silver knife with a rounded end. "Without a point? Are they afraid we'll start stabbing each other, or what?"
"Such knights," exclaimed Fringilla, "have been used in Beauclair since the times of Duchess Carolina Roberta, Anna Henrietta's grandmama. It infuriated Caroberta when, during banquets, the guests used the knives to pick their teeth. And you can't pick your teeth with a knife with a rounded end."
"You cannot,"
agreed Angoulême, contorting her face roguishly.
"Luckily they've also given us forks."
She pretended to put the fork in her mouth,
but stopped on seeing Geralt's menacing look. The young knightling on her right chuckled shrilly. Geralt picked up a dish of duck in aspic and served Fringilla. He saw Caer doing his uttermost to satisfy the baron's daughter's whims while they gazed at him. He saw the young knights buzzing around Angoulême, vying with each other to pass her dishes and chuckling at her foolish jokes. He saw Milva crumbling bread, staring at the tablecloth. Fringilla seemed to read his thoughts.
"She's done poorly, your taciturn companion," she whispered, leaning towards him. "Why, it can happen when a seating plan is being drawn up. Baron de Trastamara isn't blessed with courtliness or eloquence."
"Perhaps that's better," Geralt said softly. "A courtier drooling graciousness would have been worse. I know Milva."
"Are you sure?"
She glanced at him swiftly.
"You aren't measuring her according to your own standards, are you? Which, incidentally, are quite cruel."
He didn't reply, but instead served her pouring her wine, and decided it was high time to clear up a few matters.
"You're a sorceress, aren't you?"
"I am," she admitted, masking her surprise extremely deftly. "How did you know?"
"I can sense the aura," he said, without going into details. "And I'm skilled."
"To be quite clear," she said a moment later, "it wasn't my intention to deceive anybody. I have no obligation to flaunt my profession or put on a pointed hat and black cloak. Why use me to frighten children? I have the right to remain incognito."
"Undeniably."
"I'm in Beauclair because the largest, best-stocked library in the known world is here. Apart from university libraries, naturally. But universities are jealous of giving access to their shelves. And here I'm a relation and good friend of Anarieta, and can do as I wish."
"I envy you."
"During the audience, Anarieta hinted that the book collection may conceal a clue which may be useful to you. Don't be put off by her theatrical gushiness. That's just the way she is. And it really is likely that you'll find something in the library. Why, it's quite probable. It's enough to know what to look for and where."
"Indeed. Nothing more."
"The enthusiasm of your answers truly lifts my spirit and encourages me to talk."
She narrowed her eyes slightly.
"I can guess the reason. You don't trust me, do you?"
"A little more grouse, perhaps?"
"I vow on the heron."
A young knight from the end of the horseshoe stood up and blindfolded himself with a sash given him by the lady sitting next to him.
"I vow not to take off this sash until the marauders from the Cervantes Pass are entirely wiped out."
The Duchess gave her acknowledgement with a gracious nod of her diamond-sparkling head. Geralt hoped Fringilla wouldn't continue on the subject. He was mistaken.
"You don't believe me, and you don't trust me," she said. "You've given me a doubly painful blow. You don't only doubt that I sincerely want to help, but neither do you believe I can. Oh, Geralt, you've cut my pride and lofty ambition to the quick."
"Listen."
"No."
She raised her knife and fork as though threatening him.
"Don't try to apologize. I can't bear men who apologize."
"What kind of men can you bear?"
She narrowed her eyes and continued to hold her cutlery like daggers about to strike.
"The list is long," she said slowly, "and I don't want to bore you with the details. I merely state that men who are ready to go to the end of the world for their beloved, dauntlessly, scorning risk and danger, occupy quite a high position. And those that don't quit, even though there seems to be no chance of success."
"And the other positions on the list?" he blurted out. "The other men to your taste, also madmen."
"And what is true manliness?"
She tilted her head playfully.
"If not class and recklessness blended together in the correct proportions?"
"Lords and ladies, barons and knights," shouted Chamberlain Le Goff loudly,
standing up and raising a gigantic cup in both hands.
"In the given circumstances, I shall take the liberty of offering a toast to her enlightened ladyship, Duchess Anna Henrietta.
Health and happiness! Hurrah! Long live the Duchess! Vivat!
And now, lords and ladies."
The Chamberlain put the cup down and nodded solemnly towards the liveried servants.
"Now, the Magna Bestia."
An enormous roast on a dish, filling the hall with its marvellous aroma, was carried in by four servants on something resembling a sedan chair.
"The Magna Bestia!" roared the revellers as one. "Hurrah! The Magna Bestia!"
"What bloody beast is that?"
Angoulême expressed her anxiety loudly. "I'm not going to eat it until I find out what it is."
"It's an elk," Geralt explained. "A roast elk."
"Not just any elk," said Milva, after clearing her throat. "That bull weighed 700 weight.
"With a fine 6-point rack, 700 weight and 40 pounds,
gruffly commented the tight-lipped baron, sitting beside her. They were the first words he'd uttered from the start of the banquet. Perhaps it would have been the beginning of a conversation, but the archer blushed, fixed her gaze on the tablecloth, and resumed her crumbling of bread. But Geralt had taken Fringilla's words to heart.
"Did you, my lord baron," he asked, "bring down that magnificent bull?"
"Not I,"
said the tight-lipped baron.
"My son-in-law is an excellent shot, but that's a male topic, if I may say so. I beg for forgiveness. One shouldn't bore the ladies."
"With what bow?"
asked Milva, still staring at the tablecloth.
"No doubt nothing weaker than a 70-pounder.
Laminate. Layers of yew, acacia and ash, glued together with sinews."
The baron slowly responded, visibly surprised.
"A double-bent zephyr, 75 pounds draw."
"And the draw length?"
29 inches.
The baron was speaking slower and slower, and he seemed to be spitting out each word.
"A veritable ballista," Milva said calmly. "You could down a stag at even 100 paces with a bow like that, if the archer was genuinely able."
"Aye,"
wheezed the baron, as though somewhat piqued.
"I can hit a pheasant from 25 paces, if I may say so."
"From 85".
Milva raised her head.
"I can hit a squirrel."
The baron, disconcerted, gave a slight cough and quickly served the archer with food and drink.
"A good bow," he muttered, "is half the success, but no less important is the quality, if I may say so, of the shot. So you see, my lady, according to me, an arrow..." "Good health to Her Grace Anna Henrietta! Good health to Viscount Julian de Lettenhove! Cheers! Vivant!"
"And she fucked him."
Angoulême finished another foolish anecdote. The young knights roared with laughter. The baron's daughters, called Quelline and Nique, listened to Caillé's tales open-mouthed, their eyes sparkling and their cheeks flushed. At the top table, the entire upper aristocracy were listening to Regis's disquisitions. Only isolated words reached Geralt's ears, despite his witch's hearing. But he worked out that the talk was of spectres, striggers, succubuses and vampires. Regis waved a silver fork and demonstrated that the best remedy against vampires is silver, a precious metal, the barest touch of which is absolutely fatal to them. "And garlic?" asked the ladies. "Garlic is also effective," admitted Regis, "but socially troublesome, since it stinks awfully." The band on the gallery played fiddles and pipes, and the acrobats, jugglers and fire-eaters showed off their artistry. The jester tried to amuse the guests, but what chance did he have against Angoulême? Then a bear tamer appeared with a bear, which, to general delight, did a dump on the floor. Angoulême became morose and subdued. It was difficult to compete with something like that. The pointy-nosed duchess suddenly fell into a fury, and one of the barons fell out of favour, and was escorted to the tower for some imprudent word. Few, apart from those directly involved, seemed bothered by the matter.
"You won't be leaving here in a hurry, your daughter," said Fringilla Vigo, swinging her glass. "Although You'd leave at once, if you could. Nothing will come of it.
Don't read my thoughts, please.
I'm sorry. They were so strong, I couldn't help it.
You've no idea how many times I've heard that.
You've no idea how much I know. Eat some artichokes, please. They're good for you. Good for the heart. The heart's a vital organ in a man. The second most important.
I thought the most important things were class and recklessness.
The qualities of the spirit ought to go hand in hand with the attributes of the body. From that comes perfection.
No one's perfect.
That's not an argument. One ought to try. Do you know what? I think I'll have those hen grouse.
She cut the bird up on her plate so quickly and violently, it made the witcher shudder.
You won't be leaving here in a hurry, she said. Firstly, you have no reason to. Nothing's threatening you.
Nothing at all, indeed, he interrupted, unable to stop himself. The Nilfgaardians will take fright at the stern note issued by the Ducal Chancellery. And even if they risked it, they would be driven from here by the Knights Errant, taking vows on the Heron with their eyes blindfold.
You're not in danger, she repeated, paying no attention to his sarcasm. Toussaint is generally regarded as an insignificant fairy tale duchy, ridiculous and unreal, and in a state of permanent intoxication and unending bacchic joy, owing to the production of wine. It isn't really treated seriously by anybody, but enjoys privileges. After all, it supplies wine, and without wine, as everyone knows, there's no life. For which reason no agents, spies, or secret services operate in Toussaint. And there's no need for an army. It's enough to have blindfolded knights errant. No one will attack Toussaint. I can see from your face I haven't thoroughly convinced you.
Not thoroughly.
Pity. Fringilla squinted. I like doing things thoroughly. I don't like anything that's incomplete, and neither do I like half measures or anything left unsaid. Thus, I will add, Fulco Artevelde, the prefect of Ridbruna, thinks you're dead. He was informed by fugitives that the Drudesses burned you all alive. Fulco is doing what he can to cover up the issue, which bears the hallmarks of a scandal. It's in his interest to do so. He has his career in mind. Even when he finds out you're alive, it'll be too late. The version he gave in his reports will be binding.
You know a great deal.
I've never concealed that. So, the argument about being pursued by Nilfgaard can be eliminated. And there aren't any other arguments in favor of a rapid departure.
Interesting.
But true. One can leave Toussaint via four mountain passes leading towards the four points of the compass. Which pass will you choose? The Druidesses told you nothing and refused to cooperate. The elf from the mountains has vanished.
You really do know a great deal.
We've already established that.
And you wish to help me?
But you reject that help. You don't believe in the sincerity of my intentions. You don't trust me.
Listen, I...
Don't explain yourself. I need some more artichokes.
Someone else had made a vow on the Heron. Cahir was paying the Baron's daughter's compliments. Angoulême, now tipsy, could be heard throughout the entire hall. The tight-lipped Baron, excited by the discourse on bows and arrows, had begun to dance attendance on Milva.
Please, why don't you try some wild boar, miss? Oh, if I may say so. There are fields of crops on my estates dug up by whole herds of them, if I may say so. Oh, you can come across some fine animals, 300-weight specimens, the height of the season. If, miss, you'd express a desire, we could, so to speak, go hunting together.
We shan't be staying here so long. Milva looked strangely inquiringly at Geralt.
for we have more serious tasks than hunting, if you excuse me, sir. Although, she added quickly, seeing that the Baron was looking gloomy, I would most eagerly go hunting game with your lordship, if there is time. The Baron's face lit up at once.
If not the chase, he declared enthusiastically, then at least I must invite you to my residence. I will show you my antler trophy, pipe and sabre collections, so to speak.
Milva fixed her eyes on the tablecloth. The Baron seized a tray of field fares, served her, and then filled her wine glass.
Forgive me, he said. I am no courtier. I don't know how to entertain. I'm pretty wretched at courtly discourse.
I was raised in the forest. Milva cleared her throat.
I esteem silence.
Fringilla found Geralt's hand under the table and squeezed it hard. Geralt looked her in the eyes. He couldn't guess what was hidden in them.
I trust you, he said. I believe in the sincerity of your intentions.
You aren't lying?
I swear on the heron.
The town sentry must have had a few too many yuletide tipples, for he was swaying. He banged his halberd against a signboard and loudly, though incoherently, announced it was 10 o'clock, although it was actually well after midnight.
"Go to Beauclerc by yourself,"
Reynard de Boisfren said unexpectedly, as soon as they'd left the tavern.
"I'm staying in town until tomorrow. Farewell, Witcher."
Geralt knew the knight had a lady friend in town whose husband travelled a lot on business. They'd never talked about it, for men don't talk about such matters.
Farewell, Reynard. Deal with the scoffing. Don't let it go off. There's a frost.
There was a frost. The narrow streets were empty and tenebrous. The moonlight shone on the roofs, gleamed brilliantly on the icicles hanging from the eaves, but didn't reach the streets. Roach's horseshoes rang on the cobblestones.
Roach, thought the Witcher, heading towards Beauclerc Palace. A shapely chestnut mare, a present from Anna Henrietta, and Dandelion.
He spurred his horse on. He was in a hurry. After the feast, everybody met for breakfast, which they had become accustomed to taking in the servants' hall. They were always welcome there. God only knew why. Something hot was always found for them, straight from the saucepan, skillet or spit, and there was always bread, dripping, bacon, cheese and pickled mushrooms. A jug or two of some white or red, produce of the famous local vineyards, was never lacking. They always went there. Since they had arrived at Beauclerc 2 weeks before, Geralt, Regis, Angoulême and Milva, only Dandelion broke his fast elsewhere.
They serve him his dripping and scratchings in bed, commented Angoulême, and they pay obeisance to him.
Geralt was inclined to believe it was like that, and that day he decided to investigate. He found Dandelion in the knight's hall. The poet was wearing a crimson beret as big as a loaf of sourdough rye bread and a matching doublet richly embroidered with golden thread. He was sitting on a curule seat with his lute in his lap and reacting with careless nods to the compliments of the ladies and courtiers surrounding him. Anna Henrietta, fortunately, wasn't in sight. So Geralt, without hesitation, broke protocol and went boldly into action. Dandelion saw him at once.
"Lords and ladies," he said pompously, waving a hand just like a real king, "if you could leave us alone, the servants may also absent themselves."
He clapped, and before the echo had died away, they were alone in the knight's hall, with suits of armour, paintings, panoplies, and the intense, lingering smell of the lady's powder.
"What fun," Geralt remarked, without excessive malice. "You shoo them away like that, do you? It must feel nice to issue orders with one lordly gesture, one clap, one regal frown. Watch as they scuttle backward like crayfish, bending over towards you in a bow. What fun, eh? My lord favourite."
Dandelion grimaced.
"Is it about anything particular?" he asked sourly. "Or just to talk for the sake of it?"
"Something particular. So particular it couldn't be more so. Say on, if you please." "We need 3 horses. That's for me,
Caer and Angoulême, and two unmounted pack horses. Together, three good steeds and two hacks. Hacks, well, as a last resort, mules, laden with victuals and feed. Your duchess must consider you worth that much. What? You earned at least that, I trust. There won't be a problem with it. Dandelion, not looking at Geralt, got down to tuning his lute. I'm only surprised by your haste. I'd say it surprises me to the same degree as your foolish sarcasm does. My haste surprises you. You'd better believe it. October is ending, and the weather is visibly worsening. Snow will fall in the passes any day now. And you're surprised by my haste. The Witcher nodded. But I'm glad you reminded me. Sort out some warm clothing, some furs.
I thought, Dandelion said slowly, that we'd sit out the winter here. That we'd stay here.
If you want to stay, Geralt blurted out, then stay.
I do.
Dandelion stood up suddenly and put down his lute.
And I will.
The Witcher audibly sucked in air and said nothing. He looked at a tapestry depicting a fight between a titan and a dragon. The titan, standing solidly on two left legs, was trying hard to break the dragon's jaw, and the dragon looked none too pleased about it.
I'm staying, Dandelion repeated. I love Anarietta, and she loves me.
Geralt still said nothing.
You'll have your horses, continued the poet. I'll order them to prepare you a thoroughbred mare called Roach, naturally. You'll be equipped, well-stocked with food, and warmly dressed. But I sincerely advise you to wait till the spring. Anarietta, am I hearing right?
The Witcher finally regained his voice. Or do my ears deceive me?
Your intellect, snapped the troubadour, is certainly blunt. I can't speak for your other senses. I repeat, we love one another. Anarietta and I. I'm staying in Toussaint with her.
In what role? Lover? Favourite? Or perhaps ducal consort?
I'm indifferent in principle to our formal and legal status, Dandelion admitted frankly. But one cannot rule anything out, including marriage.
Geralt was silent again, contemplating the titan fighting the dragon.
Dandelion, he said finally. If you've been drinking, sober up. If you haven't taken a drink, do so. Then we'll talk.
I don't quite understand why you're talking like this.
Dandelion frowned.
Then have a little think.
What about? Does my relationship with Anarietta shock you so much? Perhaps you'd like to appeal to my good sense. Skip it. I've thought the matter through. Anarietta loves me, and do you know the saying? The favours of duchesses are uncertain,
Geralt interrupted.
Even if your Anarietta isn't flighty, and if you'll excuse the frankness, she looks that way to me, then what?
Duchesses only marry musicians in fairy tales.
Firstly,
Dandelion puffed himself up,
even a boor like you must have heard of morganatic marriages. Must I give you examples from ancient and modern history? Secondly, it'll probably surprise you, but I'm not from the hoi polloi. My people, the Dalettenhoves, come from...
I'm listening to you, and I'm amazed,
Geralt interrupted again, losing his temper.
Is my friend Dandelion really spouting such balderdash? Has my friend Dandelion really gone completely mad? Is Dandelion, whom I know as a realist, now beginning all of a sudden to live in the sphere of illusion? Open your bloody eyes, you dolt.
Aha! Dandelion said slowly, tightening his lips.
What a curious reversal of roles. I'm a blind man, and you, meanwhile, have suddenly become an attentive and astute observer. It was usually the other way around. And, out of interest, what don't I notice that you can see? Eh? What, according to you, should I open my eyes to?
For instance, drawled the Witcher, the fact that your duchess is a spoiled child that has grown up into a spoiled and arrogant turkey cock. That fact she, fascinated by the novelty, has graced you with her charms and will dump you immediately when a new busker with a newer and more beguiling repertoire comes along.
What you're saying is very base and vulgar. You're aware of that, I hope.
I'm aware of your lack of awareness.
You're a lunatic, Dandelion.
The poet said nothing and stroked the neck of his lute. Some time passed before he spoke.
We set off from Broquelon on a deranged mission, he began slowly. Taking a lunatic risk, we launched ourselves on an insane quest for a mirage without the slightest chance of success. A quest for a phantom, a daydream, an absolutely impossible ideal. We set off in pursuit, like idiots, like madmen. But I didn't utter a word of complaint, Geralt. I didn't call you a madman. I didn't ridicule you, for you had hope and love in you. You are being guided by them on this reckless mission. I was too, as a matter of fact. But I've caught up with the mirage, and I was lucky enough that the dream came true. My mission is over. I've found what is so difficult to find, and I intend to keep it. Is that insanity? It would be insanity to give it up and let it slip through my fingers.
Geralt was silent for as long as Dandelion had been earlier.
Pure poetry, he finally said, and it's difficult to rival you at that. I won't say another word. You've destroyed my arguments, helped, I admit, by your quite apposite ones. Farewell, Dandelion.
Farewell, Geralt.
The palace library really was immense. Its dimensions were at least twice those of the Knight's Hall. And it had a glass roof, owing to which it was light, although Geralt suspected it was bloody hot during the summer. The aisles between the bookshelves were narrow and cramped, so he walked cautiously in order not to knock any books off. He also had to step over volumes piled up on the floor.
I'm here.
The centre of the library was lost among the books, which were arranged in piles and columns. Many were lying quite chaotically, individually or in picturesque heaps.
You, Geralt.
He ventured among the canyons and ravines between the books and found her. She was kneeling among scattered incunables, leafing through and categorizing them. She had on a modest grey dress, hitched up a little for convenience. Geralt found the sight extremely seductive.
Don't be horrified by the mess, she said, wiping her brow with her forearm, because she was wearing thin, dust-stained silk gloves. The books are being inventoried and catalogued, but the work has stopped at my request, so I could be alone in the library. I can't bear strangers' eyes on me while I'm working.
Sorry. Shall I leave?
You're not a stranger.
She narrowed her eyes slightly.
I enjoy having your eyes on me. Don't stand like that. Sit here, on the books.
He sat down on A Description of the World, published in folio.
These shambles, Fringilla indicated around her with a brisk gesture, has unexpectedly made my work easier. I was able to get to books that are normally lying somewhere at the bottom of a heap that's impossible to shift. The ducal librarians moved the mounds, a titanic effort, thanks to which some literary treasures and rarities saw the light of day. Look, ever seen anything like this?
Speculum aureum. Yes, I have.
I apologize. I forgot. You've seen plenty. That was meant to be a compliment, not sarcasm. And take a glance at that. It's Gesta Regum. We'll start with that, so you'll understand who your Ciri really is, whose blood flows in her veins. Your expression's sourer than usual, did you know? What's the reason?
Dandelion.
Tell me.
He did. Fringilla listened, sitting cross-legged on a pile of books.
Well, she sighed after he'd finished. I admit, I expected something of the kind. I noticed long ago that Anarietta was betraying symptoms of lovesickness.
Love, he snorted, or a lordly whim.
You seem not to believe.
She looked at him piercingly,
in sincere and pure love.
My beliefs, he said, aren't the subject of debate and are beside the point. It's about Dandelion and his stupid...
He broke off, suddenly losing confidence.
Love, Fringilla said slowly, is like renal colic. Until you have an attack, you can't even imagine what it's like. And when people tell you about it, you don't believe them.
There's something in that, the Witcher agreed. But there are also differences. Good sense can't protect you from renal colic, or cure it.
Love mocks good sense. That's its charm and beauty.
Stupidity, more like.
She stood up and walked towards him, taking off her gloves. Her eyes were dark and profound beneath the curtains of her eyelashes. She smelled of ambergris, roses, library dust, decayed paper, minium and printing ink, oak gall ink and strychnine, which was being used to poison the library mice. The smell had little in common with an aphrodisiac, so it was all the stranger that it worked on him.
"Don't you believe," she said in a changed voice, "in sudden impulses, in unforeseen attractions, in the impacts of fireballs flying along collision trajectories, in cataclysms?"
She held out a hand and touched his arms. He touched her arms. Their faces moved closer, still hesitantly, vigilantly, as though they were afraid of scaring away some very, very timid creature. And then the fireballs collided and a cataclysm ensued. They fell onto a pile of folio volumes, which scattered in all directions under their weight. Geralt pushed his nose into Fringilla's cleavage, seized her powerfully, and grabbed her by the knees. Various books impeded him from pulling her dress up above her waist, including The Lives of the Prophets, which was resplendent with intricate initials and illustrations, and De Hemorrhoidibus, a fascinating but controversial medical treatise. The Witcher pushed the volumes to one side, impatiently tugging at her skirt. Fringilla raised her hips enthusiastically. Something was chafing her shoulder. She turned her head. A study of the midwife's art. She quickly looked the other way so as not to tempt fate. On hot, sulphurous waters. The temperature was rising indeed. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the frontispiece of the book her head was resting on. Remarks on inevitable death. Even better, she thought. The Witcher was fighting with her underwear. She lifted her hips, but this time gently, so it would look like an accidental movement and not provocative assistance. She didn't know him and didn't know how he reacted to women, whether he didn't perhaps prefer the kind that pretend they don't know what they want to those that do, and whether it would discourage him if her knickers were hard to take off. The Witcher, however, wasn't betraying any signs of discouragement. On the contrary, one might say. Seeing that it was high time, Fringilla spread her legs enthusiastically and vigorously, knocking over a tower of books and fascicles, which slid down on them like an avalanche. A copy of Mortgage Law bound in embossed leather came to rest against her buttock, and a copy of Codex Diplomaticus decorated with brass edgings against Geralt's wrist. Geralt assessed and exploited the situation at once, placing the bulky tome where it belonged. Fringilla squealed because the edgings were cold, but only for a moment. She sighed loudly, let go of the witch's hair, spread her arms, and seized a book in each hand, her left grabbing Descriptive Geometry, her right an outline study of reptiles and amphibians. Geralt, holding her hips, knocked over another pile of books with an unwitting kick, but was nonetheless too occupied to worry about the volumes falling on him. Fringilla, moaning spasmodically, thrashed her head from side to side over the pages of Remarks on Inevitable. The books subsided with a rustle, the sharp scent of old dust making their noses tingle. Fringilla screamed. The Witcher didn't hear it because her thighs were clenched against his ears. He threw off the bothersome History of Wars and the Journal of All the Arts Necessary for a Happy Life, impatiently fighting with the buttons and fastenings of her bodice. He wandered from the south to the north, unintentionally reading the inscriptions on covers, spines, frontispieces, and title pages. Under Fringilla's waist was the exemplary farmer. Under her armpit, not far from her small, charming, jauntily pert breast, on ineffective and recalcitrant shire reeves. Under her elbow, economics, or a simple exposition on how to create, divide up, and consume wealth. He read Remarks on Inevitable Death, with his mouth on her neck and his hands near Shire Reeves. Fringilla emitted a difficult-to-classify sound, neither a scream, a moan, nor a sigh. The bookshelves shook. Piles of books trembled and tumbled down, arranging themselves like rocky Inselbergs during a severe earthquake. Fringilla screamed. A rare book, the first edition of De Lavi Senesis et Figuris Comicis, fell from its shelf with a crash, followed by a collection of general horsemanship commands, taking down with it John of Atre's heraldry, embellished with beautiful prints. The Witcher groaned, kicking over more volumes as he jerked a leg straight. Fringilla screamed once again, long and loudly, knocking over Contemplations or Meditations for Every Day of the Year, an interesting anonymous work which had ended up on Geralt's back for no apparent reason. Geralt trembled and read above her shoulder, learning, like it or not, that Remarks had been written by Dr. Albertus Rivas, had been published by the Academia Sintrensis, and had been printed by the master typographer Johann Froben Jr. in the second year of the reign of His Majesty King Corbett. All was silent, save only the rustle of books slipping down and pages turning over.
What to do? Thought Fringilla,
touching Geralt's side and the hard corner of Deliberations on the Nature of Things with lazy strokes of her hand.
Should I suggest it, or wait until he does? As long as he won't think me flighty and immodest. What will happen if he doesn't suggest it?
Let's go and find a bed somewhere, the Witcher suggested a little hoarsely. It doesn't do to treat books like this.
We found a bed, thought Geralt, letting Roach gallop down an avenue in the castle grounds. We found a bed in the alcove in her chambers. We made love like mad things, voraciously, greedily, ravenously, as though following years of celibacy, as though storing it up for later, as though at risk of celibacy again. We told each other many things. We told each other very trivial truths. We told each other very beautiful lies. But those lies, although they were lies, weren't calculated to deceive.
Excited by the gallop, he steered Roach straight at a snow-covered rosebed and made the mare jump it.
We made love and talked, and our lives became more and more mendacious.
2 months, from October to Yule. 2 months of furious, greedy, wild love. Roach's horseshoes thudded on the flags of the courtyard at Beauclerc Palace. He passed through corridors, quickly and soundlessly. No one saw or heard him. Not the guardsmen with halberds, killing time on their sentry duty by chatting and gossiping. Nor the slumbering lackeys and pages. Even the candle flames didn't flicker when he passed by the candelabras. He was near the palace kitchen, but he didn't go in. Didn't join the company, who were inside, disposing of a small cask and something fried. He remained in the shadows, listening. Angoulême was speaking.
There's something bewitched about this place, this fucking Toussaint. Some kind of charm hangs over the whole valley, especially over the palace. I was surprised at Dandelion, I was surprised at the Witcher. But now I'm nauseous, and I've got a weird feeling in the pit of my stomach. Shit, I even caught myself... I'm not going to tell you that. Seriously, let's get out of here. Let's get out of here as fast as possible.
Tell that to Geralt, said Milva. It's him you should tell.
Yes, talk to him, said Caer somewhat sarcastically, during one of those brief moments when he's free, between the two activities he's been engaging in for 2 months to help him forget.
As for you... snorted Angoulême. You're mainly available in the park, playing at hoops with the Baron's daughters.
Pshaw, no two ways about it. There's something bewitched about this bloody Toussaint. Regis disappears somewhere at night. Auntie has a tight-lipped Baron. Shut it, you brat, and don't call me Auntie.
Come, come, Regis interjected placatingly. Girls, take it easy. Milva, Angoulême, let there be concord. United we stand, divided we fall. As Her Grace the Duchess, Lady of this country, this palace, this bread, dripping and gherkin, says. Another drop, anyone?
Milva sighed heavily. "We've stayed here too long. Too long, I tell you. Too long we've sat here in idleness. It's driving us mad." "Well said," said Kaia. "Very well said." Geralt cautiously withdrew, soundlessly, like a bat. He passed through corridors, quickly and soundlessly. No one saw or heard him. Neither the guards, nor the liveried servants, nor the pages. Not even the candle flames flickered as he passed by the candelabras. The rats heard him, raised their whiskered snouts, and stood up on their hind legs. But they didn't take fright. They knew him. He often went that way. In the alcove, it smelled of charms and witchcraft, ambergris and roses, and woman's sleep. But Fringilla wasn't asleep. She sat up in bed, threw off the eiderdown, enthralling him with the sight, and taking possession of him.
"You're here at last," she said, stretching. "You neglect me dreadfully, Witcher. Get undressed and come here quickly. Very, very quickly."
She passed, quickly and soundlessly, through the corridors. No one saw or heard her. Neither the guardsmen, idly gossiping at their posts, nor the slumbering liveried servants, nor the pages. Not even the candle flames flickered as she passed by the candelabras. The rats heard her, raised their whiskered snouts, stood up on their hind legs, and followed her with their black, beady eyes. They didn't take fright. They knew her. She often went that way. There was a corridor in Beauclerc Palace, and at the end a chamber, the existence of which no one knew about. Neither the current lady of the castle, the Duchess Anarietta, nor the first lady of the castle, her great-grandmama, the Duchess Adimata, nor the architect, the celebrated Peter Faramond, who made extensive modifications to the building, nor the master masons, who worked according to Faramond's plans and guidelines. Hell, even Chamberlain Le Goff, who was thought to know everything about Beauclerc, didn't know about the existence of that corridor. The corridor and the chamber, disguised by a powerful illusion, were known only to the palace's original elven builders. And later, when the elves had gone and Toussaint became a duchy, to the small number of sorcerers linked to the ducal house, including Artorius Vigo, a master of magical arcana and great specialist in illusions, and his young niece, Fringilla, who had a special talent for illusions. Having passed quickly and noiselessly through the corridors of Beauclerc Palace, Fringilla Vigo stopped in front of a fragment of wall between two columns decorated with acanthus leaves. A softly spoken spell and rapid gesture made the wall, which was illusory, vanish, revealing a corridor apparently blind. At the end of the corridor, though, was a door, disguised by another illusion, and beyond the door, a dark chamber. Once inside, not wasting time, Fringilla launched a telecommunicator. The oval looking glass became cloudy, and then cleared, lighting up the room, illuminating in the darkness the ancient dust-laden tapestries on the walls. A large room plunged in subtle chiaroscuro. A round table with several women sitting around it appeared in the looking glass. 9 women.
"Greetings, Miss Vigo," said Philippa Eilhart. "What's new?"
"Nothing, unfortunately," replied Fringilla, after clearing her throat.
"Nothing since the last telecommunication. Not a single attempt at scanning."
"That's bad," said Philippa.
"Frankly speaking, we'd counted on you uncovering something. Please at least tell us, has the Witcher calmed down now? Are you capable of keeping him in Toussaint at least until May?"
Fringilla Vigo said nothing for some time. She didn't have the slightest intention of mentioning to the lodge that only in the last week the Witcher had called her Yennefer twice, and both at a moment when in every respect she was entitled to hear her own name. But the lodge, in turn, was entitled to expect the truth, honesty, and a legitimate conclusion.
"No," she answered at last. "Probably not until May. But
I'll do everything in my power to keep him here as long as possible.
Corrid, a month's